Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and I imagine Wes Anderson discovering Michael Cera is like Oppenheimer discovering highly enriched uranium for the first time, the ultimate weapon. Joining me today is Devinder Hardawar.
This movie confirms something we've always known. Bryan Cranston got game.
And Jeff Cannata.
Just curious if either one of you would care for a hand grenade.
Yes, sir. Thank you kindly.
Those are vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Wes Anderson's newest film, The Phoenician Scheme. Of course, before that, we got some film news to discuss. We got a slash film court we're going to do today, and then some what we've been watching. A lot of stuff to get to. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. But before we get to anything, I do want to provide a little update on a topic that we discussed last week. You know, last week, Jeff Cannata described the plight of his book, Best Summed Up, a limerick book.
The ultimate film limerick quiz book.
That's right.
A only one.
Limerick book. Limerick book, he
Yet
says.
Another one. You're right. How dare I?
How dare you not use the definitive article when discussing the ultimate film limerick quiz book?
When describing in such pedestrian terms, that is goodness. A shame. Shame on me. And short version of the story for those who did not listen to the episode, the book company that Jeff published the book with, they were not run well, and Jeff is probably not getting any money from the book.
There's no probably about it.
And we had put the call out like, hey, did you get your book? Did something go wrong? Did you pay money and not get what you were owed? And we heard from several people, that not only had they gotten the book, they had gotten two copies erroneously. And many people were very nice, like saying they're willing to ship the other copy to somebody who didn't get their copy. So thank you for that. We really appreciate that. That's very,
very cool. Yes.
And then we also heard from a few people who ordered the book and did not get the book. And our response to that is we do want to make that right. However, we believe that people are still in the process of getting the books.
Yeah.
Is our sense, right? And so what we would ask is if you order the book and did not get the book, be patient. Like, wait, let's wait like a couple more months before we decide to give up on that. And then if by that point, let's say in a couple months from now, you still have not gotten the book, at that point, we will figure out a way to get you a book or give you a refund or something like that.
Again, we have nothing to do with it.
Yes, that's right.
But we are committed to, you know, because people supported this project
yes.
through this podcast, we are committed to doing everything in our power to sort of make this right. But we have no control
yes.
over the process.
I have don't no have idea. A huge pile of Best Summed Up books in my garage that I'm refusing to ship. Sadly, I would love to be not shipping those books myself, but yeah. it is not up to me.
We have no access to them. We have no insight. We have literally no one to reach out to. There's no, we're in as much of the dark as anybody else. We just are obviously committed to trying to, you know, make this right for folks. And I'm encouraged, and so much as I can be at this point, that I keep getting messages almost daily of folks saying, "Oh, mine just arrived. Mine just arrived." So I think we're in the, there's still a possibility yours will arrive phase of this process. So as Dave said, hang tight. And if it turns out that you paid for one and did not get one, we will do everything we can to try to rectify that.
Yeah. I would also say if you did write into slashfilmcast@gmail.com and you did not get a book, we would love to hear if you end up getting one. That would be useful information to know. So anyway, thanks to everyone. I think overall, Jeff, the reaction was one of immense support and sympathy for you going through this horrible situation with this book. You know,
well, I'm very grateful. Remain grateful to this awesome community and our listeners overall. So thanks everybody for that support. It means a lot to me.
A couple pieces of film news I wanted to mention before we get to an email slash film court. This week on the Patreon page at patreon.com/filmpodcast, we're going to be covering Ballerina from the world of John Wick. or actually the other way around, from the world of John Wick Ballerina.
You got to start with the thing people know.
Yes.
Or you could just say a John Wick, you know, like
what?
A limerick book.
Oh, I see. I see. Yes. that's right. I could say that. A John Wick universe movie.
Yeah.
A John Wick universe set movie is what I could say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, Ballerina, we cover that in the After Dark. We've already recorded that episode. Me and Jeff recorded it. Great episode. You will get that episode early and ad-free and the entire episode if you are subscribed to patreon.com/filmpodcast. But I wanted to mention that the movie did not open super great. It cost around $90 million. It had a $25 million opening. That is actually under tracking. People were expecting it to open around $30 million. And
such a bummer because it's good.
It's a huge bummer because Jeff and I like the movie and you'll hear us discuss it in the After Dark. But John Wick Chapter 2, that movie from many years ago opened to $230 million, right? So it opened under John Wick Chapter 2, which came out many years ago, and yeah, it's a shame because I feel like unless this movie really does well in the coming weeks, we're probably not going to see a Ballerina 2. That's kind of my sense. And
or maybe other from the world of John Wicks.
Yeah, maybe, who knows, unless they can make it cheaper, you know. But yeah, so really sad about that. I do hope people turn out for this one. After I record this podcast, I'm literally going to see that movie again with my brother. I'm taking my brother to go see it after this.
You're seeing
podcast.
A Len Wiseman movie twice, but I suppose not really a Len Wiseman movie, as we learned. We'll talk when I see it. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, we can. We can talk about it. Yeah. I would also recommend that you listen to the Going Rogue podcast, which dives into what exactly was reshot in Ballerina. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of discussion of reshoots for Ballerina, Chad Stahelski coming back in and reshooting some things. So anyway, Ballerina, unfortunately, didn't do the greatest. Okay. Here is another headline. During the review of Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, spoilers for Mission Impossible The Final Reckoning. So just skip forward a few minutes. Skip forward to the Slash Film Court music if you don't want to hear spoilers for Mission Impossible The Final Reckoning. All right, here it comes. So towards the end of the movie, there is this, it's on the poster, there's this gigantic, incredible fight sequence that takes place on a biplane. And Tom Cruise is hanging off the side of the plane. You see him do it. It's on the trailer. It's in the poster. Like, everyone knows about that sequence. There is a sequence that occurs immediately after that where Tom Cruise jumps off the plane, parachutes to the ground, but his first parachute, again, spoilers here, gets damaged. It gets set on fire. And he needs to take the parachute off and redeploy the emergency parachute. Right?
Cool shot, by the way. Yeah.
Very cool.
Which, very similar to something that happened to me once. I'm not
even
joking. Oh,
yeah, we got
to
hear that story, Jeff.
We got to hear that whole story, Jeff.
Okay, what is that an after? Can we do that now? Is that an after dark? What do you think?
It feels like an after dark, but we could do it now if you prefer.
Let's do it now. Let's do it
now. That time I almost died.
Let me do this thing. Let me
finish that thing.
And then I want to hear the story. Because a lot of people were like, hey, what was up with Jeff's parachute story? Okay, headline from... So during the review, Jeff asked the question, did he really set a parachute on fire? I did not know the answer at the time. But now I do. According to Hollywood Reporter here, Tom Cruise sets Guinness World Record for dangerous Mission Impossible stunt. The actor has officially made the Guinness Book of World Records for the climactic moment in Mission Impossible The Final Reckoning. We all know Tom Cruise hung off a biplane for real in Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, which is highly impressive on its own, but you probably assumed what happened next in the film involved some CG trickery. Cruise's Ethan Hunt grabs a parachute from the damaged biplane and leaps out, but his main chute catches on fire, so Hunt cuts away his main chute and deploys his reserve chute at the last second. But this stunt also was done practically, with Cruise leaping from a helicopter at 7,500 feet in Drakensberg, South Africa, with a fuel-soaked main parachute that was rigged to be set ablaze.
That's nuts.
He performed the highly dangerous stunt 16 times.
What? For literally 4 seconds of movie.
Yeah.
In a video that was released, Cruise explains, what I'm going to do is I'm going to be deploying, and if this is twisted while it's burning, I'm going to be spinning and burning. I have to kick out of the twist and then ignite. I got 10 seconds. The Guinness Book of World Records declared that Cruise set a record for the most burning parachute jumps by an individual. End quote.
No. Was there a previous record?
Most burning parachute jumps. Yeah. Previous record was one.
I recently learned by watching that H Bomber Guy 4-hour video about plagiarism that Guinness Book of World Records, not really a thing. Not really. Yeah. It's a novelty book company.
That's right.
That does PR. Like you can what you can do is you can contact them and say like,
pay
hey,
them.
I'm gonna pay you.
Yeah.
You know, $50,000 or whatever.
It's the Webbies for dumb shit, basically.
That's right. See also every YouTuber who wants to just have them over. They'll show up for any YouTuber. Show,
it's like you're thinking. I'm thinking whenever when I was young, I bought the Guinness Book of World Records. It's like this big, thick book, and I'm like, oh, this is
there
so
was a
official.
TV show. There was legitimacy to this thing.
TV show, and then you grow up and you realize, oh, they'll basically do a world record out of anything. You can hire them to come to you and then do a world record thing as a PR stunt, right?
Like it's a good gig, man. That seems like a real good good grift right there. It's like hey, I'll come over and watch your thing, and then I'll write down you did that thing.
You did, most umbrellas opened in 1 minute or whatever the hell. Like
I wrote it down. Pay me.
Okay, putting that aside. Still very impressive that he set his parachute on fire 16 times.
Right? I want to know after time 13, they're like, you know what? I think we need three more of these.
I think it's Tom Cruise that said that. I think Tom Cruise.
Of course.
Chris McQuarrie is like, hey.
We're fine on the burning parachute thing.
We got it. We got it.
Tom's like, I got the Guinness guy. He's standing right here.
Yeah. We could do it. We could do this. We could go all the way to 16.
That's extraordinary.
Just what?
But can you imagine leaping out of a plane with a fuel-soaked parachute? Is the thing like that's?
I have a separate story, but I have also leapt out of a helicopter. Mm. And it's
Jeff,
on video.
You gotta stop jumping out of things.
it just feels like hey, a lot could go wrong soaking a parachute with fuel. Like, what if the fuel gets on the other parachute, for instance? You know, I would be pretty worried about that.
You know what's funny is that Tom Cruise probably looked more natural doing his tumbling, parachuting while on fire than he does while eating popcorn. Have you guys seen that video?
He's
just like launching popcorn into his mouth at like 50 miles per hour because he can't do anything like a normal human being.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
He's more comfortable falling out of things than
he doesn't need therapy. He's okay. He's all right.
I would guess just, to temper this slightly, it's a very impressive and well, you can't take anything away from that.
Yes.
But I would guess the word soak is a bit of an exaggeration,
a misnomer, a malapropism, as it were.
Neither of those things, but I would say an exaggeration,
a spoonerism,
a malapropism,
spoonerism, as it were.
There you go. Yeah.
All right, Jeff. Should we go to commercial break first, or should we hear your story?
Yeah, go to commercial break first.
All right. We're going to take a break.
The folks a tease.
Yes. We're going to take a break for a sponsor. We'll come back and talk about Jeff's time that something went wrong with his parachute. So we'll be right back after these messages.
This episode of the Filmcast is brought to you by Huel. Let me tell you something. The honest truth, right before I sat down to record this, I just finished drinking my Huel for the day. It's the strawberry banana, my favorite flavor of Huel. And if you look around my workspace here, there are a number of empty Huel bottles, which doesn't speak well to my general tidiness, but it does speak well to how much I love Huel. Because, ladies and gentlemen, my life is a shambles. My life is chaotic. I'm trying to pick my kids up from things, take them to other things, fitting a podcast recording in between those things. I do not have time to just whip myself up something to eat. But that is where the Huel Black Edition RTD comes in. This is my go-to. It keeps me full. It keeps me energized. It keeps me focused so I can tackle all of those things, whatever the day is throwing at me. If you don't have time to cook, no problem. Grab a Huel. It's got you covered. That's Huel, H-U-E-L, and their Black Edition ready to drink. It is a complete meal in a bottle. With 35 grams of protein, 27 vitamins and minerals, high fiber, and low sugar. So you feel full, focused, and ready for your day. There's no prep, no cleanup. Well, I guess I gotta clean up these bottles. But you just grab it and go. Huel's already sold over 500 million meals around the world, and now it's your turn to try it. New customers get 15% off at Huel.com when they use our code FILMCAST. Let me tell you, I have tried a number of shakes and other kinds of drinks. Most of them taste like sand. I would not be so into Huel if it didn't taste great. They have a number of delicious flavors, vanilla, chocolate, iced coffee, my favorite, strawberry banana. You can get a variety pack or you can focus on one. And Huel is incredibly affordable. With high protein meals less than $5, it's a budget-friendly option that I'm genuinely excited about. I'm telling you, I am a subscriber to Huel on my own, from my own pocket. And you can be too. 15% off for new customers when they use our exclusive code FILMCAST, F-I-L-M-C-A-S-T, at Huel.com. That's H-U-E-L.com. Please see our description for terms and conditions. Skip the stress, not the nutrition. Try Huel today for complete nutrition bottled.
All right, Jeff Cannata, tell us about your encounter in the world with parachutes.
So I'm doing a Mission Impossible movie.
Uh-huh.
No. So I was in college. I had never gone skydiving before. I was with the two buddies in college, and we were bored. And somehow it came up that we all had a desire to do it, and we said to each other, let's just do it. We didn't tell anybody. I got so much flack from my mom later that, like, I didn't inform anyone that we were doing this.
That'd be helpful.
We drove to Temecula, California. If anybody knows Temecula, there's not much there, and which makes it a great place to go skydiving. And we went to the skydiving place. If you go skydiving your first time, if anybody has done this, you tend to go tandem skydiving. So the responsibility of deploying the chute or knowing what you're doing or everything is not solely on your shoulders. You have literally another person on your shoulders. You are strapped to their tummy, basically. The back of you is pressed against the front of them, and you're attached to each other. And so you go out of the plane together. You have to – the process of – have either of you guys gone skydiving before?
No.
I've not. Always wanted to.
Yeah, it's a blast.
I know you start with tandem, and then you need to take like a week of classes if you want to do it by yourself, basically. Yeah.
So the process of tandem skydiving is you're in the plane. They open the big door. It's amazing. You're looking out and over a vista. And it's the coolest thing about skydiving is that there's no frame to your view. It's just open sky. And it's amazing, the view of it. Anyway, so then you kind of sit on the edge of the plane and the person behind you says, okay, we're going to, count to three. We're going to fall out. You kind of tumble out. And he said, what you need to do is the most important part as the tandem skydiver is you need to go into an arch. I think they call it an arch. Maybe it's been a minute since I've done this. Anyway, so you kind of bend your back and put your arms out. Everybody has seen a skydiver in a movie.
It's the classic skydiving pattern.
Yeah, it's so that it levels you out and the wind is pressing you upward so that, and you're creating a large surface area for that wind. So it kind of presses you out. You're in that classic skydiver position of falling sort of parallel to the ground. So, make an arch is what happens. You fall out for a second, make an arch, and then you level out, and then you free fall for, I don't know how long, a ways. And at a certain point, the person in your ear, because they're literally right behind you, whispers in your ear and says, okay, do you want to pull the chute? And you get to reach up, grab this thing.
Oh, you get to pull it. That's cool.
Yeah, it's cool. Usually they let you. I don't, obviously it would vary from thing to thing, but I was able to pull my own. And you reach up, you grab this cool, lever thingy and you yank it and your chute goes up. So I do all of that. Make an arch. Wow, we're making an arch. Ah, this is amazing. Ah, I'm screaming. Ah, it's crazy. Got the goggles on. The wind is shooting by. Ah, all right. You want to pull it? Yeah, I want to pull it. Grab the thing, yank it. What's supposed to happen is the chute goes and it, it makes this
very
beautiful
satisfying
canopy
sound.
Yes, this wonderful canopy. Mine went.
Bad sounds.
Not the sound you want to hear when you're parachuting.
Not the sound you want. But this is my first time. I don't know anything's wrong. I'm like, ah, Scott, this is awesome. The guy behind me goes, leans into my ear and he goes, I'm going to need you to make another arch.
Double arch it.
Yeah.
I'm going to need you to make another. Also, please shut the fuck up. Stop celebrating.
Yeah. I have no idea that anything's going wrong. I have no idea that as far as I know, this is what you're supposed to do. He pulls a different lever, cord, whatever. The parachute releases, the one going releases, flies off. And we go back into the arch, and then he does something else, and the parachute opens. We, the backup chute opens. We glide gently to the ground. What happens also is there's a guy in a van who comes, and so it's me and my two buddies. So there's three of us. They're all going to guy in a van comes and picks us all up, and you know we're all like, oh wow, you know they land after me. How was it? Oh, it was amazing. It was awesome. We get in the van. We sit. In the van, we're driving back to the facility, and they're like, well, we got to swing by and pick up the other chute that was released. And the one dude who was attached to my back turns to another dude that was attached to my friend's back, and he goes, I owe you a meal. You know, I got to buy you dinner. And we're like, why is that? He's like, oh, he packed the emergency chute, so he saved our lives.
Great.
And that was when I pooped the gold brick. Because I realized everything that just happened. Like it all, it's like that moment, that moment when in the Matrix, when it all just like comes together and you realize what just all those bits and pieces that I didn't put together now make a cohesive whole. And I realize the entire story of what just happened. And so they were literally like, you saved my life because you packed my emergency chute. We go and we pick up the original chute. We go back. But weirdly enough, one of the things my wife uses as proof that I'm not altogether there, that was not the last time I skydived. I chose to do it again.
Yes, babe,
that did not discourage you. Yeah, that did not discourage you.
I leapt out of a helicopter next, which was even cooler because you get to be sort of stationary in the air and just sit there as long as you want and wait. And
but it's not as high though, Jeff, right?
Still 10,000 feet. 10,000 feet both times.
Okay.
I think that's the standard sort of beginner distance.
But how did you process that event, Jeff? Were you just thinking, that's a thing that happens and it's fine and it's normal and I don't really care, you know? Or...
Well, I mean, like I said, I had a moment of really kind of realizing that we cheated death.
Yeah.
But I also realized that's why you have the backup chute, right? You know, the first one doesn't deploy correctly. You have the backup one. The backup one doesn't deploy. Well, I guess you're SOL. But, luckily that didn't happen. The coolest thing about it, I thought, was how calm the dude was about it.
Yeah.
They set the tone and he wasn't freaking out. If he had freaked out, I would have freaked out. And he was just like, I'm going to need you to make another arch. Like, this is how we do it.
He was the Tom Cruise of tandem Jeff Cannata skydiving things.
It was weird that we soaked the chute first.
Well, we'll soaked with his piss. You know, like
that's what
it was. Imagine how the art of skydiving, what went through like the entire history of it to figure all this out, right? Like maybe don't hold yourself straight down because that person felt like a brick. You get an arch. Maybe two parachutes.
Yeah. How many times did it take before we went, we could have a second chute here?
Not very big. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it didn't discourage you from going again, it sounds like, right?
It did
you were
not.
Just like, that's fine. That's
As cool. I said, my wife believes that's proof that I'm not too smart. But because she wouldn't be caught dead on a
parachute. Most definitely. My brother had the situation where he went on one of those like loop-de-loop roller coasters. The secure bar didn't lock. So pretty much hanging on for dear life. I'm like, these things just happen. Things just fail out there. So I'm going to say no to skydiving. You know,
I'm just one of those people that values the thrill more than and sort of trusts the process.
Right.
And I figure like if it's my time, it's my time. But I don't know. I, I, I don't want to live worried about what could happen. Mm-hmm. I want to try to take advantage of the, you know, the joy of these experiences. And I loved it. Again, yeah. The reason I did it again, well, we did it for a show, but that's a different
yeah.
thing. Actually, I don't want to get, you know, we don't need to go too far off the rails here, but I also went bungee jumping. I don't know if you guys have done that. I found bungee jumping much scarier than, because you do it.
You fall.
And you
all the
feel
way.
Like you're yeah. falling. When right. you're skydiving, you don't feel like you're falling. You feel mm-hmm. like you're hovering and the wind is shooting by you, right, but you're just right. kind of chilling and it's the most amazing view ever.
Right. Everything is coming after towards you rapidly. If
yeah.
you're
but the, jumping. But your perspective, cause you're so high up, you're not seeing the ground moving toward you. It's a gradual thing because you're just kind of chilling in the air and you're looking around. It's amazing. And it's a rush, but it's not with bungee jumping. When you step off the bridge, as I did, your body goes, I am plummeting to my death because yeah, right. you feel like you, because what I didn't realize until I did bungee jumping is there's no tension on the bungee cord until there is. But you are just falling
right,
until
right.
all the slack of the bungee cord yeah. runs out and then you hit and then you feel like, oh, I got me. And then, you know, the harness gets pulled and you go, oh, there's something caught me. But until that, you're just falling. And if you feel like you're falling and you constantly and that whatever, however many seconds it is, not many, but it seems like a long time when you're falling and you go, oh, the bungee cord should have caught by now.
Yeah,
I should feel some tension by now. Why am I not feel? Oh my God, it's all and then it happens. You know, it's much scarier, in my opinion, than skydiving.
No, that totally makes sense. Again, how did we come up with this? Who in their spare time was like, I need a bouncy thing and I'm going to jump off this bridge?
Yeah.
Humans are weird.
This reminds me, guys, I got to tell you about this movie I started watching and did not finish, but now I will finish it for our next episode of the podcast called Fly on Hulu. This was released in IMAX, I think.
Yeah.
And it is about base jumping and specifically wingsuit diving. And it's on Hulu right now. And it's a documentary. And I started watching it. And there's some really cool footage. There's some really cool ideas in the documentary that I want to talk about. So that's a little tease for next week's what we've been watching.
I feel like the wingsuit fatality rate is pretty high.
Extremely.
Because there's nothing saving you. Yeah.
The other thing is another tease, by the way, for next week's what we've been watching. For those who want to like kind of do a little book club style thing, I watched a documentary about the Ocean Gate Titan submersible this week. And I'm not going to talk. The reason I'm not talking about it this week is because Netflix's big Ocean Gate Titan submersible movie is coming out this week. And so I'm going to watch them both and compare them.
It's like a Firefest doc situation.
That's right. I did a comparison of those two. And I'm going to do a comparison of the two Ocean Gate submersible documentaries as well. So if you are into that at all, which I don't know why you would be. Those are some things that you can watch to catch up with me for.
This is to remind people. This is the terrible tragedy of the people that died in the submersible.
That is
right?
Correct. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah.
So again, don't know why you would be, but
don't know why you would be, but I am. So okay, a little tease for next week. All right. Before we get to what we've been watching, though, let's do a slash film court, which is our very irregular segment about your movie related dilemmas.
We need to do that more often just to hear that bumper. Yeah. It's so good.
Yeah. I want to give a shout out to Simon M. Harris for that bumper music. You know, Simon M. Harris sent over the original slash film court music, and then I asked him for a shortened version, and he provided that one. And I was looking back. I went to go get the music for today's episode, and I realized I had thanked him for the original music, but I never thanked him for the shortened version. So, Simon, if you're still listening to this podcast, thank you for both versions, the long and the short version of the Slash Film Court music. But yeah, it's a great bumper, piece of bumper music. All right. Colin writes in from Minnesota to slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Hey, guys, I saw Ballerina with my father yesterday. And during the film, the man next to me, his phone was on his lap, and it kept lighting up with notifications. 30 minutes in, I asked him to put it in his pocket, and he responded with, "The light is dim, it won't bother you." To which I responded with, "Obviously it's bothering me if I'm bringing it up." He ignored my request, and I just figured I did the best I could and tried to ignore the light that flashed in my eyes the remainder of the movie. During the end credits, I turned to my father and started complaining about the man. I am on the spectrum, so sometimes, especially when I am heated about something, I don't know how loudly I am speaking. My father told me to quiet down for other people watching the credits and that I was being just as bad as the guy who had his phone out. Which brings me to my film court question. Is talking, admittedly probably pretty loudly, during the credits of a movie rude? And if so, is it just as bad as having your phone out during it? I appreciate your podcast and appreciate your time reading this. End quote. Okay.
Depends on how loud.
Couple questions, right? Like, number one, how rude is it to have a phone in your pocket that's like lit up and people can see it through your pants?
Phone on your lap.
Well, that's not what he was doing. He said he asked him to put it in his pocket.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. On his lap. Yeah.
Absolutely rude. Yeah.
Extremely rude. I mean, not as rude as the person last night at my How to Train Your Dragon screening, who literally during the climactic moment of the movie received a phone call and answered it and started talking on the phone during the most emotionally potent moment during that movie. Mm-hmm.
That's through a screening, not even a normal viewing, right?
I was also at a How to Train Your Dragon screening last night, and also during the most important moment of that movie, the little girl and her father in front of me, she said, "I have to go pee." He stood up, lifted her up over the back of the seat directly in front of me, and then walked as like the coolest moment of the movie is happening. They were just leave. And I'm like, I get it. I'm a father. Yeah. I get it. Yeah. I know when your kid has to pee, you got to go. But timing.
Sit on the sides.
The other thing that pissed me off is that they came back during that same sequence. I'm like, you can hang out and wait until the movie kind of chills for a second, right?
That he has control.
You can return.
I've done that before.
But anyway, yes. Obviously, phone in lap during movie, flashing in your eyes. Not cool.
Where is your phone when you guys are at the theater? What's your rule?
Deep in the pocket.
In your pocket. Yeah. I learned many, many years ago that's a bad idea because I don't know if it's my pockets or something, but when you do the recliney, those phones go flying, and then they go between the seats, and that is a freaking nightmare because you don't want to fish your hand there. So I try to do my pocket. I have like a messenger bag. It's often there too, but I often just do like if it's an AMC or Regal with a little table, phone screen side down, the phone there.
You need deeper pockets, Devendra. Deeper pockets.
I don't know what it is.
Though. I actually have a man bag, and I do put the phone in there sometimes. All the way.
I prioritize pocket depth on my pant purchasing.
That's an important thing.
Okay, so we all agree this guy was being an asshole who was having the phone on his lap and it was lighting up and distracting people. You should not do that. Now the question is, Colin speaking, probably not being able to control the volume of his voice, and let me just say, Colin got a lot of sympathy for that, okay? Because my wife often needs to tell me to tone it down with the volume.
I speak made a career of it, folks. Yeah,
I speak at podcast voice virtually all the time, and it is not welcome in this household necessarily. Also, I think a lot of people really enjoyed when I got bronchitis and couldn't talk. So they're like, "Oh, this is a version of Dave I never hear when he's not screaming all of his thoughts." It's very nice.
A little Ira Glass action over here. Yeah.
So I want to start
Dave, go suck on your bronchitis rag so you can get more bronchitis, please.
I want to start by saying I have a lot of sympathy for Colin, who is so incensed at this rude patron that he is chewing him out metaphorically. I don't even know if the guy's there anymore. Probably he's gone during the
credits. It sounded like he was there, actually.
I hope so. But I hope he was.
Yeah. There.
This is where my conflict lies about all this, because I like the I'm speaking loud enough in complaint about you that you overhear it.
Yes.
I enjoy the passive aggression of that.
However, if somebody is staying through the credits of the movie,
yes,
they probably want to A, pay attention to what's on screen, and B, hear the music. Right?
It'd be nice.
Those are the two components of what the credits are. And if you are being really loud, you are probably distracting them from doing that.
You know? If you're staying through the credits, you wanna be in the vibes of the movie.
Yes.
And don't ruin the vibes. That's the main thing.
We saw How to Train Your Dragon with my wife and her brother and my nephew were there at the theater. And my wife was very sweet because the movie How to Train Your Dragon is 2 hours long. It's 30 minutes longer than the animated version.
This is a trend, by the way, with all these live action remakes. Yeah. They're all longer.
Yeah.
And it's weird.
And my nephew was getting pretty freaking restless by the end of the movie. And so the movie is over and like they bolt out ASAP. But my wife says to me, Hey, if you want to stay behind and watch the credits, like go, like we understand. And that was very nice of her to think about that, because that was a significant possibility. Cause it's like, maybe there's some really crazy ass John Powell, How to Train Your Dragon music going on.
She knows how much this means to you.
Right.
Basically.
Now I didn't end up staying.
He wants
because
to stay till the last of the credits is done.
That's right. Now in this case, I didn't stay because everyone, you know, I didn't want to make it weird. But yes, I mean, if I stay, it's because, I want to experience the ambiance of this music and these credits.
But the difference is you weren't being a dick earlier.
Well, you don't know that, Jeff, but yes.
I don't think the dad is not worried about the assholes.
Yeah, he's worried about Colin. He's worried about Colin.
It's fine. Right. I will say, though, quiet talking, quiet response, quiet reflection on what you just, museum level. Oh, this is really interesting.
Yes.
Look at the first AD was. Look at the key grip was.
I think that's fine.
That's fine.
But if you're saying loudly, boy, that guy was an asshole, you know, like, that's not great, probably.
But I think this is such a life lesson, because if in any point in your life somebody asks you not to do something because it is disrupting them or disturbing them, if you take that moment to be like, no, I don't care what you say, I think there may be limits to that, but that is a clear sign that you're just an asshole, dude. This person is clearly disturbed by what you're doing, and you just don't care enough to care about another human being. Wow.
I have some perhaps controversial thoughts about this moment in time, which is
here it comes.
The credits moment in time. Okay, so first of all, I want to anecdotally, the How to Train Your Dragon screening I went to last night, again, a press screening, but open, it was also other folks
public.
There.
Yep.
Quite chaotic. But also, no spoilers for How to Train Your Dragon, but suffice it to say, the final shot of the movie is kind of a sweeping, you know, from far away, right?
It's an operatic sweeping wide angle shot.
Yes.
Say. Okay.
As you might expect from any movie. The lights went up during that shot.
Mm.
Like it was programmed badly. And it's, you know, right before the credits start.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting.
That's a mood killer.
It's a mood killer.
Awful.
It's a cue to the audience that, like, oh, it's time to start behaving differently.
Yeah, no.
So usually when it's interesting that the timing of the lights coming up in the credits, sometimes it's dark through a large portion of the credits. Sometimes the lights come up as the credits begin. You know, you get a lot of variance there. And I think the lights coming up is a cue for most people that it's okay to sort of resume normal activity. Now, you guys are probably going to disagree with this. I definitely agree with you that talking loudly during the credit. I'm on record saying talking loudly at any point when you step in that theater. The movie can be off, but you're in the theater. I don't want to hear your conversation.
That's right.
I don't want to overhear what you and Nancy did earlier in the day. I don't want to know.
Bring us back.
I'm in my world. I don't want to be in your world. Anyway. So I totally agree that we should not be talking loudly.
All I care about is what you and Nancy did.
Dave is there to find out about.
I'm there to find out How is Nancy doing, really?
That's right.
What's
up with her divorce? Let's dig into it. The controversial thing that I will say is, I think when the credits begin, not the end of the movie, but the credits beginning.
Yes.
I think it's fair game to check your phone. Not be loud about it.
Yeah,
pull your phone out, full brightness, look at your messages.
Log it in your letterbox, which is what I do generally. Yeah, yes.
Not full brightness. Yeah.
I agree, Jeff. Like pull out the phone and, but then here's the question. Why aren't you leaving the theater to do that? Like, why are you sitting there? You know, like.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to enjoy the music and sit in the thing and then pull out your phone and see all the messages that you were politely ignoring through the entire runtime.
I think I'm probably fine with that. You know, as long as you're not blasting that brightness, I think it's probably fine.
That's how it goes in. Yeah. It's still on silence and all that fun stuff.
Yeah. All right. I expect more pushback on that. But.
No, totally agree with that. I still think you take the you need a soft level volume at all times in the theater.
Agreed.
I think that goes a little too far, Jeff. They and I'm glad you have these now. Noise canceling headphones exist. If you want to live in a world of complete silence, you can.
Well, but even when I'm with someone else,
I
want to be talking in a very respectful tone, so that the people around me aren't involved. But people sit down and they're like, "Oh man, so tell me about that rash that you did. It go away?" And I'm like, "I don't want to know. I don't want to know your personal business. Like, we're not." Yep. You're not in your home.
Wow,
it's weird.
Jeff, you and I are so different. You and I are so different because I'm like,
I know way too much about.
Tell me
rashes.
About the rash, you know?
Please. And also, like, if
I don't
you're
know about
going
you, Jeff,
to.
I go to the theater to experience something real. And
Dave is the only time Dave is around other humans. And
hearing about
so
James'
curious
rash.
About their human behaviors.
Hearing
and
about James'
dramas.
Rash is going to be something that, you know, anyway, sorry, go ahead, Vinyra.
I do think those louder conversations happen more at press screenings. Because you're seeing your friends that you don't always see, and critics don't all work in an office together. So like maybe once a week you get to see this guy who you're cool with, and you're like, hey, how are things going? So it's literally a live download. It's an office, like a press screening theater is kind of an office for a lot of people, and your office level voices. Yeah,
indeed. All right, well, Colin. Sorry, our answer probably is not quite what you're hoping
was
for.
Was at the end of that story? Did the guy respond to him being loud?
That was the end. So, but Colin was asking us to adjudicate, can you talk at loud voice during the credits? And our answer is basically, we don't think you should, because the people there are there to experience the credits.
Big caveat for me, though, the passive-aggressive, let this guy know how much of a jerk he was by just talking to your friends about it, I think is a... is a carve out for me. Yeah. Talk loud so this jerk knows what he did.
I think I agree with Jeff on that. So but we don't know enough.
Yeah.
But Colin, we hope that gives you the tools to know whether or not to feel bad about this movie related situation. /filmcast@gmail.com is how you can send in your movie related dilemmas. We'd be happy to adjudicate. The film court has ruled. All right. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back. What's up?
I was just saying we need a hammer mallet
hammer,
drop
gavel
right
sound
there.
Effect.
Get on that, Dave.
Yeah. All right. I'm working on it, Jeff. All right. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. You know, there are over 6 million men in the United States alone that suffer from depression every year, and it's often undiagnosed. That's because men face immense pressure to perform, to provide, and to keep it all together. But I think it would help all of us guys to remember it's okay to struggle. Struggle is normal. And real strength comes from opening up about what you're carrying and doing something about it so you can be at your best for yourself and for everyone else in your life. If you're a man and you're feeling the weight of the world, talk to someone, anyone. A friend, a loved one, a therapist. I certainly have benefited from therapy in my life, and I think it is an option that more people should consider. We need to get rid of the stigma around it. With over 35,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally. And it works. With an App Store rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client reviews, it's convenient. You can join a session with a therapist at the click of a button, helping you fit therapy into your busy life. And you can switch therapists at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Talk it out with BetterHelp. Listeners to the Filmcast get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/Filmcast. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Filmcast. FILMCAST.
Time to get to what we've been watching, folks. Few things to talk about this week. I just want to give a shout out to this movie, Mountain Head, that is streaming right now on HBO Max, the one to watch for HBO. This is Jesse Armstrong, the creator of Succession's newest film about tech bros hanging out at a mountainside retreat.
I really want to see this.
And I, you know, here's the thing. I quite enjoyed the movie when I saw it. But also, I think a lot of people are not going to care for this one. And I think the reason is, you know, first of all, they apparently all, like, this, the whole, the production, the writing, the shooting, the editing, the putting this out, all happened within the course of 1 year. I think maybe even less than that, because he really wanted it to be topical. He was saying on interviews, hey, if I wait too long to release this movie, some other outrageous thing that a tech bro has done will reveal itself, and then this will seem woefully outdated. And so I think that it shows, like, the script and the film, like, it really drags during the first half of the movie, I would say. And the narrative momentum doesn't feel fully there. I think this movie is great because it reveals that tech billionaires, or it kind of demonstrates the pathologies of tech billionaires, how little they think of us, how weird some of their beliefs are. And I think that's really important, given that a lot of the media at least used to idolize these people, and they do have a huge hand in dictating what our futures are. So I think it's, like, valuable to watch this movie. I don't know that the people that quote unquote need to see it will actually see it on HBO Max, the one to watch for HBO. And that's a bummer. But I think this movie is kind of doing a public service. It's intermittently very funny. A lot of the script is quite sharp. And it has a message that I really support and want to get out there, which is these tech billionaires, they are not your friend. And they haven't necessarily put much more thought into the products they're releasing than you do, than you have, right? and I think that's a really important message to get out there. So ultimately, I recommend it, but I can also see a lot of people, you got to have patience. It's really like a play, really. And
yeah.
And the first half is like, doesn't really drag, and the second half is very different than the first half, and is really out there. So anyway, kind of a mixed review, but overall I liked it and would recommend it, and I'm a big fan of Jesse Armstrong and anything he does. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing this. I do feel like his fear kind of rang true, because at this point a lot of people are well aware that the tech billionaires are sheer assholes and don't know what they're doing, and we had one that has basically destroyed our government for decades. So, you know, I don't know how much people want to see these folks revel in a ski chalet at this point, but I want to see this.
I'll just say that they're not all just having a good time for the whole movie. And we'll leave it at that. Sure. So,
I mean, it's Jesse Armstrong. Yes, he's going to torture his characters. We know.
Mountain Head is the name of the movie. It's on HBO Max, the one to watch for HBO. That's something I've been watching. Devendra Hardwar, something you've watched this week.
Yeah, I want to shout out Poker Face Season 2, which I've been slowly making my way through. I just want to say, this show is such a delight. Like, why can't all TV shows be like this? And what specifically... be like how TV shows were in the 80s and maybe a lot of the 90s, where you got your main character, they got a particular set of skills. Every week, they're in a different location, different guest characters, different, like, mystery or thing to solve. This show remains so much fun. It is so, so inventive. Like, what there, we know the kind of extent of Natasha Lyonne's truth-telling or bullshit detecting powers from season one, but they really play with it in season two.
Yeah.
The guest cast is kind of amazing. Like, the first episode with Cynthia Erivo, doing incredible stuff. There are the episodes are kind of hit or miss, but I think overall, like, still really enjoyable. Like, I just love sitting and being in this world. Like, the writing remains really sharp. Natasha Lyonne is a delight to watch, and the guest actors are just like always
the
on
highest
point.
Caliber. The highest caliber.
Yeah, in one episode, we see Katie Holmes, who's been trapped in her youth, married to an older man, a situation that she really just can't escape from. And, you know, I think she plays that pretty well. I think she kind of knows how that, goes.
Is the guy soaking anything in anything?
There's a lot of soaking. Actually.
So, yeah. So guys, look, I am not going to spoil Poker Face Season 2, Episode 7. But I think it is fair to say that Season 2, Episode 7 of Poker Face, it is basically written for film cast fans.
Oh, boy.
I'm only going to give away one...
Motion smoothing one?
The motion smoothing one, right. So Sam Richardson plays a character that hates motion smoothing so much that he brings a universal remote with him everywhere so that when he goes to like a store or a bar that has motion smoothing on, he can deactivate it using his remote.
I'm so glad you remembered to bring that up because I've been meaning to talk about that. It's so beautiful to see that moment, to see that idea represented,
that representation.
Like, we're not alone. Yeah. It's, you know, we talk about
feeling seen. You were like, I've never felt seen before in a movie, and now you have.
This is our superhero. This is our avatar. You know, he represents us in popular culture. He can do it. It's beautiful.
And that's just one component of the episode. Well, I'm not even going to give away all the other stuff of the episode that like is very clearly targeted at film nerds.
Yeah.
And again, I don't even want to spoil it, but suffice to say, it is unbelievable how many references in that episode are designed for people who listen to this podcast. I'm just put that out there. That's a great one. But yeah, Season 2 of Poker Face, highly enjoyable. Agree with you, Devendra. Some of the episodes have not been great, but overall, they are very, very fun.
And it's always fun. It's fun. It's inventive. It is like going back and watching Knight Rider or The A-Team or any of those old shows where it's like, they're not some great ones. But the episodic nature of it just is such a blast. And when I don't feel like watching anything else, when I'm tired, Poker Face is there. Feels good. More TV should be like this.
I was just thinking about Knight Rider recently.
Yeah, Knight Rider.
Just the fact that it was one of my favorite shows as a kid. I used to watch it with my dad. We obsessed about it. And the idea that like everything depicted in that is reality now.
Yes.
It's wild.
Mm.
Wild to me.
Absolutely wild.
Except the cars are causing crimes these days. Okay, anyway.
hey, cars cause crimes in Knight Rider.
That's true.
Knight Rider predicted that.
It's all car crimes.
It's all cars car crimes.
Causing and solving crimes. That's the
entire billionaires having too much power. That was in Knight Rider.
Yes.
You know, not being able to trust your cops or your government. That's there too. Yeah.
So that is Poker Face Season 2. It's on Peacock right now. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you've been watching.
Well, I checked out a new half-hour sitcom that has hit Apple TV Plus. It is starring Owen Wilson, and it is called Stick. Stick. And this is about a sort of has-been golfer played by Owen Wilson. And he encounters this young kid who he identifies as a golf prodigy who has, you know, supernatural golf abilities. And he is going to mentor this kid and sort of use the kid to pull him out of his life malaise and, you know, sort of ride his back and make him into a superstar of golf. I'm not a golf guy. I'm not interested in golf. Don't care about golf. But I was drawn to the show because I like Owen Wilson and I like half-hour sitcoms. Also, his best friend and former caddy is played by Marc Maron, who is now a former podcaster. You know, I believe he created podcasting.
Yeah.
Like just a few years after we were already doing it.
Yeah.
And now
we outlasted him, though.
We outlasted him. Take that.
In your face, Marin.
WTF that, buddy. We're still here doing it. And all you're doing is starring in movies and television shows.
Yeah, all you're doing is enjoying the millions and millions of dollars you've made from podcasting over the years. Meanwhile, we're still here. We're doing it.
We're making tens of dollars.
We're taking tens of dollars screaming into the void. So
anyway, it's fun seeing Marc Maron in this part. Judy Greer plays his ex-wife, because if you're a quirky, kind of funny dude, you are required to have once been married to Judy Greer.
That's
on
right.
Camera.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right.
Yep.
She's legally mandated to be in this role.
To be everyone's ex-wife, quirky ex-wife. I love Judy Greer, but man, she is.
It's sad.
Got a lane. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. She's got a lane. More power to her. Here's the thing about this show. It's not particularly funny. It's kind of doing something that we've seen before, like this magical kid who has magical golf powers somehow just was born with magical golf powers. Okay, it's fine. But it's charming enough. Like Luke Wilson. Owen Wilson is charming. Like, he's a charming performer. And so it rides the back of his charm. And I think it's perfectly watchable. It's a perfectly cromulent show. It's just not particularly special in any way. The end of the first episode has a real dark turn that I actually had to stop watching. It's about, you know, kids in peril. And that was hard. And there's a sort of an undertone of real melancholy in the show that I don't think it needs. It's like, you're doing a half hour show. Let's maybe make it a little more fun. The show is kind of, it's fine. It's fine. I don't think I'm going to keep watching it, but it's not bad. It's just not particularly special in any way. And I wish it was having a little bit more fun. It takes itself, I think, a little too seriously and is much more of a dramedy than a pure comedy.
Right.
And, you know, kind of not what I was hoping for when I tuned in. But I watched several episodes and they're perfectly watchable. If you're looking for a diversion, and especially if you're into golf, like, it's a fun kind of golf world show where, you know, it takes place in the golf world. So it's kind of a fun golf thing. If you're into golf, just not my bag. No pun intended.
I forget. Did you watch Shrinking, Jeff?
No, I know. Everybody
tells me. Shrinking
is kind
of in this lane, but more success. You would love Shrinking. And it's like genuinely funny and sweet. And Harrison Ford is incredible in Shrinking. Yeah.
I never tried it. Well, actually, that's not true. I tried it.
I think you tried something.
I watched the first episode and it didn't hook me. And then everybody was like, it gets so good. And I was like,
It does. It does.
Yeah. Here's what I'm going to say. I really feel like, Devendra, we made the right choice in telling Jeff not to watch Bring Her Back. If the stuff in Apple TV Plus's Stick bothered you about children in peril, then Bring Her Back, dude.
It just comes out at the end of Stick, the end of the first episode of Stick. I won't spoil anything, but the way it's delivered is very, I think, emotionally manipulative and kind of, it's sort of sideswipes the viewer, and it's like, hey, feel this. And I just felt like, you know what? I don't want to. I didn't come here for that.
I don't care to feel.
Not this particular thing. Don't do that to me. In this kind of like dopey, goofy, kind of saccharine sweet little fluffy comedy, you're going to like deposit that at the end of the first episode and just be like, oh, by the way, feel. I don't know. I just felt tonally off and unfair in my opinion.
Yeah.
But then the show just kind of swerves right out of that. You know, the next episode, we're just back in our kind of fluffy fun. But, you know, whatever.
I enjoyed reading some reactions from people that listened to our Bring Her Back review without having seen the film. And that is just
Just let us paint a picture of that movie for you.
What happens in that movie is wild. Wild. Okay, anyway.
The bummer about Stick is that, you know, I'm an Olyph fan. Huge fan of Timothy Oliphant. Mm-hmm. He shows up in two episodes. I did not get to his episodes. Like, I didn't make it to his episodes, and I don't think I ever will. Because I don't think he shows up until like episode 4, and I watched the first 3. So
I don't. Did you guys see the trailer for the alien show that's coming up?
Alien Earth.
Alien Earth. Oliphant is in it, and Oliphant in sci-fi alien. That looks fun. I cannot wait.
Wow. Yeah, Oliphant, Jeff. You know, I was a little bit confused for a second because I thought you were referring to your fandom of Ollie Haskivy, the Cleveland-born actor.
We call ourselves Haskivians.
Oh man. I hurt myself just now. Okay. All right. So that's something Jeff Cannata has been watching this week. I want to mention that I went back and rewatched 28 Days Later in preparation for our review of 28 Years Later in a couple weeks.
Not 28, not to be confused with 28 Weeks Later, which we'll be covering in a couple of days.
Right. What do you mean?
That tickled me. Because you said I watched 28 Days Later, which we'll be covering to prepare for 28 Years Later in a couple of weeks. And I said, not to be confused with 28 Weeks Later, which you'll be covering a couple of days.
I see. Okay. Okay. Well,
sometimes the jokes are just for me.
The thing is, we are going to be quote unquote covering it in a few days because I was going to watch 28 Weeks Later in preparation.
We should talk about.
Yeah.
Yes.
So next week, Devendra, you want to catch up for the next podcast episode? Watch 28 Weeks Later.
I love.
It's been
28
years
weeks
since we
Let's
talked about weeks, okay, and, okay, you, which we will in a few days.
Okay, you got to stop that. please stop pursuing this path. I'm begging you. So, 28 Days Later, this movie is still, in my opinion, a masterpiece. Just the level of filmmaking on display is incredible. The acting, the way that they were able to convincingly show you a post-apocalyptic London, just the shot composition is incredible. In most of the film, there's just like shots that it's like, wow, like very unconventional choices, which is kind of how Danny Boyle likes to run.
And a film that would have been like impossible to make with a standard film camera. Like it is showing what you can do with DV, right? Basically,
I mean, yes. Yeah. In like there are certain shots that would have been really hard to get with the convention, and undoubtedly using a fairly almost consumer grade Canon digital camera to shoot this movie allowed them to operate more nimbly and get shots that they wouldn't be able to get, like handheld stuff that they wouldn't have been able to get otherwise if they were using a conventional kit.
Yeah.
The problem is that it looks like the movie was shot on a potato. And that's
it does it looks like butt, you know.
Yeah, it does not.
But sometimes you want 4K
look
butt.
Good. And look, I understand that like it the aesthetic of the movie does help the movie in some regards because it's so low grade and cheap.
It's dirty.
Yeah, and it's you're coming out of the apocalypse in London and it's supposed to be grimy and look, I get that. And also, at the end of the day, I would still kind of prefer that the movie look good. That's kind of because the movie is so good. Sure. It's like playing The Last of Us Part 1 on PlayStation 3. You know, it's like, okay, that's a really good game. And also, I would prefer to play the remaster or not even the remaster, the remake, right? That the one they did remake on the PS5 and PC,
well, it's
right?
It's like. It's about how things hit aesthetically, right? Like when I Shadow of the Colossus is a game that I really love. The PS2 game. There's a game also defined by its limitations, you know. And I think that was always a core part of it. I think that's kind of it here too, right? Like they couldn't be super clear. They had to shoot like in a different way. When I reviewed the Shadow of the Colossus remake, I'm like, you're missing it. You're missing that majesty of like a mysterious fog that kind of clouds the world or something. So, you know, it's not going to look pristine. Especially the late 90s, the stuff where people were experimenting with DV, a lot of Michael Mann stuff, you know, early on. There's some stuff he did in Miami Vice that people are like conflicted about.
Yeah.
It's interesting though, because we're never going to get that again, right? Where is that aesthetic experimentation?
Right. I mean,
happen
literally, from your iPhone can shoot yeah. better footage than what the yes. Canon XL1 was with what they shot this movie.
So Danny
on.
Boyle was like, "What about 25 iPhones or something?" Right? Like he has right. a crazy rig yeah. for the new movie.
Yeah, he's using. Yeah. He's you should see the kind of and I love that. I love that. Yes. First of all, iPhones can be graded to look like cinema yes. cameras now. So it is. We are past that point. And if you've seen these behind the scenes photos, he has people wearing these rigs of 25 iPhones, and the idea. Is I don't think they're going to do a bullet time. Is my sense? My sense is they are wearing these rigs so they can just choose whichever cuts they want. They can choose this angle at this moment, whenever
total
they
freedom.
Want. You know, like it's going to be groundbreaking. I think. Anyway, so
I feel
love
for the
that,
editor though.
Yeah, definitely. But I love that he's continuing to push the medium forward and trying new things. I just wish that it just is like this movie intersected at this moment in time. Mm-hmm. When these digital cameras came, like the Canon XL1, which is like, it aged very, very poorly. It aged very poorly. Also, Devendra, for some reason, Alex Garland had this thing where, hey, let's have the ending of a movie, spoilers for 28 Days Later, where the guy goes Super Saiyan and is like basically becomes a superhero at the end, which is, by the way, extremely similar to the ending of Sunshine, another movie that he also wrote.
I will tell you, having talked to the guy, it's not often his choice. It's often you're making a movie, your budget's running out, you have to shoot an ending. You have to shoot an ending.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas so, if you're writing a novel, you can chill. You can like craft things exactly how you want it. So yeah, it's unfortunate. Like basically Sunshine turned him off of working with big studios altogether. Mm. So yeah.
Because all the studio notes are like, we gotta have a scene where the guy goes superhero mode and starts killing
crazy.
Everyone. Like that's. That's kind of a common refrain in these movies.
It's just, it's like...
Really cool and satisfying in 28 Days Later. Mm-hmm. Also just kind of comes completely out of nowhere. You know,
you got to end the movie somehow. Might as well have him be a
might
badass.
Might as well
like,
have
that's
one guy beat the shit out of all the enemies. You know, which
that's
is,
what you came
is,
to see.
Yeah.
Something we don't talk about enough, by the way, not just the score of this movie, but I think the soundtrack of 28 Years Later is also, or of 28 Days Later, is fantastic. It was something I played... forever, like after I saw this movie, and people don't really talk about the soundtrack of this thing very much, but
yeah,
man,
it's a great score. It's a great score and a
great
soundtrack
score and music.
Also, Naomi Harris has not aged. It's actually incredible. This movie came out 25 years ago, basically. We just saw her in Black Bag. She looks the same, which is amazing.
Love her.
So yeah, she's awesome in that movie as well. But anyway, 28 Days Later, incredible movie. It's a shame that like we have this 28 years later. It's gonna lead the 28 years later is coming out. It's gonna lead to people rediscovering the older films, and then they're gonna get to this one. It's gonna look like crap, and it's probably gonna turn them off. And that is a bummer. That is a bummer.
I'm not looking forward to the TikTok kids, the kids who were basically the kids who were born after 9/11, who have now become full fledged adults. When they go back. And they discover early pop culture, which is just stuff from the 90s. They don't know how to take it, folks. It is getting kind of sad. So I don't know. Not looking forward to that. I am looking forward to talking about 28 Weeks Later, though, which I think, say what you will about like the end of that film, which is kind of a mess.
Similarly problematic ending. Yeah.
One of the best film openings.
Yes.
I think I've ever seen.
Like, agreed.
It hits so hard. So
really well done.
I love that movie just because of that.
Really well done. So
yeah.
28 Days Later, still a masterpiece, still really like the other thing I just want to mention about 28 Days Later, just a lot of different scenarios in 28 Days Later. Like they keep like inventing new scenarios as the movie goes on of like, what if you're in a house and the zombies attack you? What if you're in a tunnel and the zombies, you know, like what if it's not the zombies that are the bad guys? You know, it's just the movie keeps you on your toes the whole time. It's just really, really well done. And of course, what's also impressive is many of the actors, actually pretty much all the actors, Cillian Murphy, Naomi Harris, Brendan Gleeson, Christopher Eccleston, all those people are still relevant today, right? They still have careers today.
And huge careers.
And that just goes to show you how good they were back. Like these were like generational talents that were in this movie that have been tapped to be in this film. Mm-hmm. So, one last thing I'll say, which is like, I'm kind of like in my mind, I'm like, is this movie one of those movies that you should remake, you know, because it looks so rough, but it would be so difficult to capture. Yeah. Like the scene of like Cillian Murphy, like getting up and walking across, I think, was it Westminster Bridge? And it's completely empty. There's nothing there. And they had to go shoot that scene at like 4 a.m. and close down the, and it's like, they wouldn't do that way today. They would do it with CG and it wouldn't look as good. Right. And so part of me does wonder, like, what would a 28 Days Later remake be?
No, thank you.
But also it's a masterpiece and you can't really remake it. So yeah. Okay. Anyway. All right. So 28 Days Later, that's something I've been watching this week. And next week I'll watch 28 Weeks Later and maybe, one or two of you guys can join for that. We can, catch up on that before 28 years later. Also, I'm just going to put this out there. 28 Days Later, a lot of stuff happened in 28 days. Like, we have now lived through a pandemic that lasted years. And so, but so when I watched 28 Days Later, I'm like, wow, society really degenerated a lot in 28 days, you know, like feels like it's been like months when that movie happened. Okay. Enough observations. That is something else I've been watching this week.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle. With ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
All right, folks, let's do some weekly plugs. Weekly plugs, a part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. I want to throw a shout out for DecodingEverything.com, my free newsletter, where I recently published reviews of Ballerina as well as Karate Kid Legends. So if you want to subscribe, keep up with all the stuff I'm doing online, as well as get movie reviews every week. DecodingEverything.com is how you can do that. Devinder Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Yeah, check out the Engadget podcast. A couple of big things over the last week. We talked about the Switch 2 launch and my experience sitting in the Best Buy line. That was fun. And also, my colleague Sherlyn Lowe was at Apple's WWDC, so she did a special episode there about everything they announced. And some kind of, not like a huge event for Apple, but new OS interfaces. I'm a big fan of new designs.
Before we get to Jeff, I just want to tell you guys, I buy my guns from a guy called T-Rex. I just want you to know, I buy my guns from a guy called T-Rex. Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug.
As Devinder was kind of mentioning, this last week was, I think, one of the biggest weeks in video games, not just of the year, but of many years. Not just because Nintendo launched their new console, the Switch 2, but also because it was the Summer of Games Week, which used to be E3. E3 is no longer, but there was a whole bunch of press conferences, direct events. And on my video game podcast, DLC, we covered all of it. It's a huge, massive, jam-packed episode. We had to go almost 3 hours long to cover it. It's so much fun. We're trying to talk about every single game that was shown. And there were, it's a deluge of games. It was just a massive amount of new game announcements and footage alongside one of the biggest console launches of all time. So if you're interested at all in video games, give this one a try. I think it's a lot of fun. It's episode 603 of DLC. It's our Summer of Games special. You can find it at dlcpod.com.
At patreon.com/filmpodcast, we got a lot of great stuff for you on the After Darks. You know, if you are a patron, you get early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, and exclusive access to After Dark episodes. We've been reviewing a lot of movies. We got Bring Her Back. We got Ballerina. Next week, we're probably going to have another movie that we're going to review for the After Dark that we're going to release publicly as well. But yeah, you can get those episodes ad-free early in advance, as well as the entire episodes. We're only putting excerpts out on the main feed if you become a patron at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We never want anyone to donate if in any way causes them financial hardship. You can always support us for free by leaving a starred review for us wherever you get your podcasts, or sharing our videos at youtube.com/@thefilmcastpod. We'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much for everyone who spreads the word about the Filmcast. It really means a lot. Let's get to our review of The Phoenician Scheme.
At this moment, rescue workers are laboring to recover and identify the remains of Zsa Zsa Korda, international businessman, maverick in the fields of armaments and aviation, among the richest men in Europe. This was Korda's sixth recorded airplane crash. He is survived by 10 children, 9 boys, 1 nun, his daughter Liesl.
I've appointed you sole heir to my estate, which you may come into sooner rather than later.
Why? It's been 6 years since our last meeting.
I have my reasons.
Which are what?
My reasons? I'm not saying.
He's a small arms dealer.
Oh, I was going to spoil that because it's a pretty easy one.
Yeah. He's a small arms dealer, guys.
No big guns.
Welcome to the Filmcast review of The Phoenician Scheme. I'm going to read the plot summary of this movie from IMDb. The Phoenician Scheme involves wealthy businessman Zsa Zsa Korda, who appoints his only daughter, a nun, as sole heir to his estate. As Korda embarks on a new enterprise, they soon become the target of scheming tycoons, foreign terrorists, and determined assassins, end quote. Devinder Hardwar, very curious, what did you think of The Phoenician Scheme?
I love this movie. I think it's an absolute blast. I don't think it's the last movie was Asteroid City. I think from Wes Anderson was reaching for more higher level territory, I think, and that movie was a little more inscrutable because of that. I enjoy that as well. This is just straight up a really, really fun time because it's always surprising you. You know, you feel like you're in the Wes Anderson, you know, aesthetic. Things can only get so violent. Things can only get so crazy. This movie just constantly surprises you. So I thought, like, just as a ride, it was a lot of fun. I like the characters. I haven't, like, fully processed what he is kind of doing here, basically giving us kind of a shitty dude, like a shitty businessman, you know, who a lot of people hate, countries basically hate. And it is an exploration of this person. Maybe, like, we'll talk about in spoilers, like, what he comes to terms to. As a subject, not exactly the thing I'd be interested in right now, but I think Benicio del Toro is great. The entire cast is great. Michael Cera is just so much fun. This is a fun time. It's just, maybe it doesn't reach the heights of the best Wes Anderson to me, but as an experience, I had a blast watching this.
Well, apparently, Benicio del Toro's character, Zsa Zsa Korda, based in part on Armenian oil magnate Kalust Gulbenkian.
That sounds like something Wes Anderson would do. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Jeff Cannata, your thoughts on The Phoenician Scheme?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say my thoughts on The Phoenician Scheme are best summed up in the form of a limerick. Wes Anderson's signature style seems only for cinema files. You know the routine, but the basketball scene makes the whole freaking movie worthwhile.
All right, so we Jeff probably will discuss a scene in the movie that involves basketball, but go ahead, Jeff.
It's a very fun scene. It's a very fun scene. Bryan Cranston and Tom Hanks.
What a pair.
United, finally, in our dreams have come true.
Yeah.
I also like this movie, but I do think that over the last few projects, Wes Anderson has just abandoned all attempt at making anything that is remotely tied to reality. It's just everything is his style, his abstraction. And it's almost like watching an impressionist painter or, you know, he's working with the film medium in a way that no other filmmaker working now does. And I find that fascinating, but I can't imagine that it's particularly mainstream or particularly accessible for most people. I mean, none of the characters behave in any kind of human fashion. None of the events play out in any, it's so stylized. It's so abstracted. I mean, it really is closer to watching stop motion. And, you know, they're really, I don't think this movie resolves in any kind of satisfying way. It's just a series of events. And he's fine with that. I think if you watch his early movies, they're almost the progression to where we've gotten, where he's just not even concerning himself with trying to create what a conventional movie is anymore. It really is this kind of diorama world that mm-hmm. I find extremely fun because it's so unique and so different. And the abstraction sort of hints at something basic, but it's like avant-garde, filmmaking from the 60s, or it's like, it really does seem like a style out of time. You know, mm-hmm. I've talked before about how I think it's very Brechtian, you know, Bertolt Brecht, the German playwright and play director. You know, it is so different. And I think actors have a great time working in that, which is why, he gets such great names to be tiny little parts in his movies, and why he has this sort of cast of recurring actors that are his kind of troupe, just like Bertolt Brecht did. Although, can somebody check on Jason Schwartzman? Is he okay? Where is he? Just is he all right?
Not been invited to the cookout
lately. What happened? Yeah. Oh, I'm very worried. Did they have a falling out?
He's in, I mean, he's in Mountain
Head. Was he busy?
You can see him there, right?
Busy working with Francis Ford Coppola? What happened? it's hard to recommend this movie to any, I mean, people who listen to this podcast are probably the target audience, right? Because you know what you're getting with a Wes Anderson, but I feel like it keeps going off this ledge. And you watch something recently like the Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar on Netflix, where it's like, oh, here's Wes Anderson adapting a story that's coherent and has a point. And it's so much more conventional and easy to recommend and like goes to a place. I feel like this movie, while I, like Devendra, had a great time watching it because, yes, it's surprising and, oh my goodness, is the character's fun, is Michael Cera delightful, but it really isn't anything other than a series of vignettes, as many of his movies are. Like many of his movies are just vignettes that barely hold together as any kind of meta story. And I feel like this one, like you said, Devendra, I don't really know what he's attempting to do. It doesn't matter. Like, I don't think Wes Anderson cares that, it's just the style on display, which I find fascinating and watchable, but I think many people will not.
It's always an aesthetic exercise with him. I think I will say, I could actually see myself recommending this because this is one of those crossover movies. This is a movie you could give to somebody who's kind of, they watch movies once in a while, and then they find that thing that's like, oh, this is unlike what I typically see. This is unlike typical Netflix Drek or something. And this could lead them towards the path of cinephile. And this is certainly one of those I would use to put somebody down that path versus Asteroid City, which is a really, really fun movie and a cool aesthetic exercise, but also definitely more high level, I think, than this one's trying to be.
I have the exact opposite opinion of these two movies. I feel like Asteroid City is the much more accessible. It's like, it's about something that we all can understand, you know, going to camp. I think it's a much more accessible movie than The Phoenician Scheme, which is just, it's so cerebral and abstracted and often incoherent.
Asteroid City also leaves its plane of existence it deconstructs itself. And I'm like, trying to explain that to somebody, I think, is tough. Whereas this one's like, at least it's one thing. You know, all throughout.
I'm just going to say I'm glad neither of you are recommending movies to people because I don't think either of those would be good. I think the...
Maybe I think a little more highly of my audience, Dave. Yeah.
I think The Story of Henry Sugar, that's the one I would go with.
That's good. Sure. That's good.
That's the one that I feel like...
Or...
very accessible.
What's the... the George Clooney stop motion Fox movie.
Fantastic Mr. Fox. I'm just talking about the movies of the last 5 years. Jeff,
The recent run. Yeah.
Boy, I wish I enjoyed this movie even as much as you guys did. I was not a fan. Here's the thing. Let me say this about Asteroid City. I did not connect with that movie emotionally, but I felt like some of the stuff it was going going for was really profound. Yes. And I admired and appreciated that. Obviously, this character who is grieving, right? Jason Schwartzman's character is grieving, right? The death of his wife, I believe. But then also, like, the idea of art. There's one sentence or a couple, one line in that movie that really sticks with me, right? Where a character says, "Don't try to understand it. Just keep telling the story." I'm pretty sure that's from Asteroid City, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And in a way, I think that line is Wes Anderson and any creative person's ethos, right? Which is people who create things, you write things, you're not, there's sometimes you don't even understand what it is you're putting out into the world, but you are driven to create it. And I feel like Wes Anderson is saying that about his own work. Like, don't even try to understand it, just create. And hearing that line gave me a lot of empathy for Wes Anderson. I feel of like he's putting this stuff out. It does, as Jeff said, it doesn't adhere to normal cinematic conventions in any way. People are connecting with it. Some people are connected with it. Some other people aren't. But he all he has to do is to keep telling the story. This movie, Phoenician Scheme, there are so many things about this movie that I want to love. Like the idea of this kind of disconnected father trying to reconnect with one of his children, obviously an extremely potent Wes Anderson concept, right? Like something that he has come back to again and again and again is this idea of like distant fathers, right?
You think this guy has daddy issues? I don't know.
You think of like Royal Tenenbaums and Darjeeling Limited, you know, like all these movies like have that.
Rushmore,
as a
everything.
Rushmore.
Right. All of them.
And I let me just say, that idea worked a lot better in those movies than it did here for me, right? And I am very sympathetic. I love that theme. That's a cool idea. You know, minor spoilers for being an Asian person in America, but Asian parents, they're not the most affectionate breed of parent. And so it's like I have a lot of empathy for that kind of like story, and I really want to connect with it. And the artifice, the way the movies are structured in this case, it just doesn't work for me. I cannot connect with it emotionally.
But I don't think this movie wants you to. I think this movie keeps you at arm's distance. Stylistically, and isn't attempting to create any kind of emotional connection. Everything is staid and presentational, and it's Brechtian, right? Bertolt Brecht like hated that notion of having an emotional connection. He wanted it all presentational and all cerebral, and I think that's what this movie is doing as well.
We can get into this when we get to spoilers, Jeff, but I don't know if I agree entirely with. I see what you're saying. Of obviously. First of all, the artifice is a lot less like dialed down here than it was in Asteroid City, right? In my opinion, Asteroid City was, we can clearly tell the background is fake. We're in the middle of a production that's this bookend, right? Like this, he really dialed it down, and I really don't know. Like the Brecht thing, I really agreed with it for the Asteroid City. I was like, yeah, you're right. Like right on, Jeff. That was absolutely correct. This one, I don't know as much if you're like what you're quote unquote supposed to experience.
And there is a catharsis for the main character,
right? Exactly. And I don't spoilers, and I didn't experience it as much as I think I should have. And the movie is occasionally funny, but it's not as funny as I think it quote unquote needs to be for me. This is just my own subjective experience. For like some of his other movies are freaking hilarious. Like I thought. I loved French Dispatch. You know, my favorite Wes Anderson is Grand Budapest Hotel. And those movies are freaking hilarious. Like, I'm laughing all the way through those movies. And this one, it just wasn't as funny for me. I don't know if it's the shtick has wore off for me, if it's just me, David Chen, at this moment in time. But I could see this movie being like, oh, if it was super funny and I had a great time throughout, I could still recommend this movie. But between the not connecting with it emotionally and not finding it that funny, I'm just not left with much to enjoy or recommend the Phoenician Scheme, unfortunately, for me, David Chen.
It's doing different things in those other movies, but I found myself cackling through this entire movie.
I laughed just a lot, like, too.
I was just like, that dude just exploded. The pilot's just like, sick of this shit. This movie's about a guy who just can't die. And I think that concept is kind of funny, too, and how Benicio del Toro plays this character who is despicable on paper, but he's also just like... kind of thinks he's invincible in certain ways too. Like, that's all kind of fascinating, and he plays it really well. He's also really compelling too. Like, the just the opening shot of this movie, just like, it's an overhead shot of this really fancy bathroom. He's in the tub after being attacked, but it's like five nurses, like just people taking care of him. Like, you're in this world where this guy is just so taken care of on a certain level, where his champagne is placed to ice in the bidet. You know, like, it's just a really interesting world he's constructing here.
I did love the opening credit sequence. It was really well done.
So you're right to say Del Toro's performance is amazing in this movie. Mm-hmm. I think it's among Benicio Del Toro's best cinematic performances.
Yeah. There's no Sicario in this one. He's really understated. Yeah.
Did you guys like Liesel, who's played by...
I love Liesel.
Mia Threpleton, I believe is her name. Kate Winslet's daughter.
Oh, really?
Wow. I didn't know that.
The face looks recognizable. I'm like, why does she look familiar? She is fantastic. I feel like everybody on board this movie, and also what this movie does with Michael Cera, chef's kiss. Not since David Lynch has Michael Cera been used to such great effect in an art project. Yeah.
He is really excellent in it. You're right.
All right, folks, let's do a few spoilers for The Phoenician Scheme starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
Can I do something here, Dave? Because I've got a way to start this off.
All right.
This week, I watched a movie in which a Spanish-speaking character or actor is forced to confront his character's recklessness and abandon and, ability to think that they can live forever, and is forced to reckon with their mortality and what they mean to other people. But enough about Puss in Boots, The Last Wish.
Ooh, goes the dynamite.
It's like the same moral core of that movie is in this one. That's a much better movie.
These movies are indistinguishable from each other.
Yeah. But that movie still rules. I just watched it with my kids. It's kind of the same deal here of a character who's just like kind of a Puss in Boots is more of a hero, but this character is a huge asshole and the world wants him dead. And he has lived his life completely amorally. And through this journey of trying to complete the Phoenician scheme, I think he learns a little bit more about himself and his mortality and what his life and what he means to other people and what other people mean to him. I think that's like the ultimate thing. Just seems like a bad time to really be, forcing us to care that much about a billionaire.
I agree with you. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish is really good.
Phenomenal.
Kicks out.
Phenomenal.
Kicks so out. Good.
Something I didn't even mention during the main review that I also really liked or is a theme that I connect with a lot is this movie has a lot of cutaways to heaven, which I think visually is very impressive, right? The way it conceptualizes it. But by the end of the movie, right, Benicio del Toro has kind of seen the error of his ways and he's given up a lot of his wealth and he's starting from nothing and he's reconnecting with his daughter. And I think I just didn't really connect with that journey, and I feel like by the end I'm supposed to be happy. I feel like I'm supposed to be like, oh, what an awesome outcome that has occurred for this character. It's heartwarming. That's what I feel I'm supposed to experience. And to my point earlier, Jeff, I didn't really get there emotionally because the layers of because this is not full artifice like Asteroid City. It's kind of just like half cocked artifice.
But it's fairy tale.
The layers of artifice like prevented me from accessing it. You know what I mean? So
you're right. It's, I wouldn't use the word artifice. I think it's still in a very highly stylized.
Yes.
Like nobody,
that's right.
Nobody moves like a human being. Nobody speaks like a human being.
Right. Right.
Nobody behaves like a human being.
Nobody plays basketball like a human being.
Right. It's all presentation. You know, honestly, this is going to be a weird reference, but maybe there's like three people in the audience that'll be like, yes. There's a moment in the Rankin and Bass Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer when what's his name? The dentist. He sings a song, and there's a moment where he does a little pirouette in the course of his song it's a stop motion thing, and he moves in a way that no It does not even attempting to be realistic. He's like,
yeah.
Has, and that's how everyone moves in this movie is
wow.
There's no, it's like, it's crazy that he directs human beings like they're stop motion animated puppets. Mm-hmm. And, I love it. It's just such a interesting style, but you're right. It's not that artifice, but it is an abstraction. It's like kind of getting to the core of how human behavior feels to the viewer by kind of taking out any kind of relatable human emotion. You know, like
yeah.
the way that Bryan Cranston like hops backward twice and then throws the ball. It's all yeah. everything is my arm moves independent of my body, right. independent of my right. torso. You know, it's just, and it all comes from Wes Anderson, right? That is directed. He's asking right. people to sort of behave in this way. And mm-hmm. Forgive me, the actress who plays the nun, you know, she is just
Mia Threpleton.
Yeah. Yeah, she's doing a great job, but she's just asked to do nothing, mm-hmm. and just say the words as quickly and you know
right yeah
most, and that it is an abstraction. It is this sort of devoid of humanity in order to sort of get at the some sort of core truth that I think Wes Anderson believes to be expressed that way. And I think there's a slight distinction between
yeah, no,
artifice, yeah. which is, you know, like everything is fake, mm-hmm. and we're acknowledging that everything is fake in the context of this fake movie,
yeah.
with a movie that is buying into the universe that it's creating, but that universe has no, is representational, is not sort of trying to be naturalistic in any sense.
Right. Great points, Jeff. And mm-hmm. I guess, when I was watching Asteroid City, I was thinking to myself, oh, I'm so out of remove from what's going on because of how artificial everything feels. Now I'm like, I should go revisit that movie because I feel like that was more effective for me than whatever this is, which is kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I remember you so, hating that movie.
Yeah, I yeah, really did not like
I,
that
I don't
movie.
Understand what you're talking about now.
But now like, I'm like, yeah. I'm like, oh, like at least like that had an ethos, you know, and this is just kind of... You know, this everyone's is, just kind of behaving so, weird in this one.
This is why I feel good about recommending it. It is just very straightforward in what it's doing, right? Sure, it's trapped in the Wes Anderson style, but it's about a dude. Dude's not so great. Dude's very pious daughter tries to help him, like is could be his savior. She and all his friends kind of like end up helping, having him figure that out. And it's so straightforward. Like that's all it is. And like every vignette is kind of interesting. Their relationship with each other, his relationship with his sons, do that whole bit. Like they should be across the street. The recurring bit with the crossbow, all fun stuff. And
so
also
funny.
Tells you like, yeah, who this character is, who's somebody who's just like, doesn't understand what to do with love too, which could be something we could point to a lot of billionaires, a lot of very rich people about not being able to access. The stuff about the sort of like afterlife, Bill Murray is God. I loved all that.
Genius.
I loved all that because also like then you kind of break out of the Wes Anderson typical frame, like the super colors and everything. Like it just looks so different. You jump into it in a really different way. And I suppose it's trite, you know, somebody having a near-death experience and starting to see the value of their life and everything and how they're living. But I found it to be effective here. That's all. Like all the little situations, we meet new characters, we meet new people and how they affect him, their relationship with each other. It's funny. Like it's just like a good time, but I'm still struggling to figure out like the higher level, you know, meaning of it all. I think he just wanted to have a kind of a romp. This feels like a Wes Anderson romp to me.
I'm going to say this, despite the fact that I haven't really connected with his last two movies, I am really grateful.
You apparently love Asteroid City, so I don't know what you're talking about here. Don't backtrack on that.
I did like The French Dispatch quite a lot.
French Dispatch is incredible.
I would put a distant third for me of
really?
Of these
That's
three.
So interesting.
Yeah.
That's so interesting that like that was... Oh, if we do French Dispatch, Asteroid City and Phoenician Scheme, like French Dispatch is my favorite of the three.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think that's, it's probably.
I think for me, it's Asteroid City, yeah. Phoenician Scheme, then French Dispatch as in the ranking.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder what that says. Anyway.
We could write a
yeah.
doctoral thesis on that, I'm sure.
It's what we're taking away from the movies. By the way, I want to shout out every time Rupert Friend props up in anything. I'm like, yes, I love that man.
Agent 47, baby.
He looks former hitman himself, Rupert yes. Friend. Looks phenomenal. Also, I think is hilarious in the movie too.
The fact that William Dafoe is in this movie just to wear a silly hat is William Dafoe just pretty great. It's like just get Dafoe. He'll show up. Put him in a hat. That's all we need.
The whole afterlife crew is F. Murray Abraham, William Dafoe, God popped up at some point too.
Yeah. So funny. It's just who he can get. You know, he can just pick up the phone. He can get all these folks.
We'll shoot in a day. Yeah.
But despite the fact that I didn't connect with these last two movies particularly much, I have to agree with what Jeff said, which is that no one else is doing it like Wes Anderson is doing it. Yeah. I am so grateful that people keep giving him money to do this. Yeah. I really am. Because
it's surprising, frankly.
Yeah, because his movies have not done that well financially, but it's like, whatever. Like, obviously the people who are financing these are not in it for the money. They're in it because...
This isn't the widest release either. Like, it's a smaller release compared to a lot of other movies.
He is creating art. And maybe sometimes he doesn't understand it. He just needs to keep telling the story. And I don't know if he thinks that statement applies to himself, but for me, regardless of whether I like his movies or not, I'm grateful to exist in a time when Wes Anderson can make movies and get them out in theaters. And that is a wonderful thing. I need people to understand that, right? Even if I'm not connecting to this one individually. So at the end of the day, it is really impressive that Wes Anderson made a movie. And that's going to bring us into this week's episode of The Filmcast. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from Tim McEwen from The Midnight. Our slash film court music comes from Simon M. Harris. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode. Next week, it's going to be How to Train Your Dragon.
Again.
Live action remake. A movie that obviously has much significance for all the folks of the podcast. And also, patreon.com/filmpodcast, The After Dark, we got a ballerina review for you coming up as well. Be sure to become a patron to get that episode early, ad-free, and the entire episode. But yeah, How to Train Your Dragon. Until next week, thank you so much for listening to The Filmcast, and we will see you later. Goodbye.